I just want to grab this. Hey, I'm Mike.
I'm Timothy.
You're the real thing.
And heads up, this episode contains adult themes and strong language.
I look at this tattoo and I see a really big green parachute and some water splashes behind it, and it's got this man gliding safely down my arm. And I see it just as what could have been.
The tattoo's on Brad's right forearm.
It represents the miracle of survival, and it kind of keeps me going. I look at it all the time and think, I don't need to be upset. I don't need to dwell on the bad things or the tiny things in life. Look at the big picture.
But the first and most important thing you've got to understand about Brad Guy.
I just had a family that were always so supportive, and when I was a weirdo, they're like, yep, go do you, be yourself, we'll be right in your corner.
Is that he loves his family a lot.
I'm such a family-oriented person. It just seems so weird to not have some sort of connection.
As well as his parents, Julie and Brian, he has three older sisters.
The oldest is Carly. She's 9 years older than me, and she's got a husband, Travis. Two little boys who are 2 and 3, Nash and Duke.
Then there's Nikki.
She's 6 years older than me, and she's got her partner, Julian. Two kids, Ayla and Blaze.
And finally, Jess, who's 3 years older.
She's got a husband, Jason.
They have a dog named Summer.
I've always been the typical younger sibling, the cheeky one that gets away with anything, and they've always wanted to protect me, and they're not surprised when I've crashed my car or I've got no money or locked myself out of my house at the airport with no passport. My family are so used to that, so I've put them through a lot.
But nothing would compare to what happened on a golf course one winter afternoon.
We're sitting in Brad's very trendy apartment in Collingwood, Melbourne. It's a fair way from his hometown of Pylong.
I do love the country and it's part of my heart and soul, but to actually be in a place where there's a hive of activity is a lot better for me at this stage of my life as a 25-year-old. You've got cafes, you've got bars, you've got hipsters, you've got immigrants and you've got locals. And
can we open that window and yes. Just let's have a look out the window, because I want to see what's...
The window's a bit rickety, but...
Wow, this is the hustle and bustle you're talking about.
Yeah. Hello! And you can shout at people as well, which is fun. So after a few drinks, we'll actually just shout at strangers, which I'm sure they don't
appreciate. There's a lady with a pram. Let me get her. No, get I'm
it.
Joking.
I'll get it. Your baby's really cute. Yeah, you. Okay.
You are yelling positive comments.
Yes. I don't believe in yelling negativity. I just want people to feel good about themselves. Me and my partner, Beau, will dress up in our rainbow mesh, get our glitter, play some diva tunes and dance on the rooftop, much to the pleasure of passers-by.
Nice one. All right.
My whole life, I felt like I stood out, sometimes for the right reasons, sometimes for the wrong reasons. Being gay in the country as well, and not just gay, but super queer, just struggled and had so much shame and self-doubt because I knew that if I express myself how I truly felt, I'm just going to cop shit and it's not going to resonate with people and I'm going to be even further alone. I knew I had different feelings to all of my friends, but I didn't know what it was.
It wasn't until Brad was backpacking around Asia with a friend that he started to feel comfortable with his sexuality.
And he was really supportive. He's like, dude, go out there, go experiment. It's still fine. It doesn't matter. So as soon as I landed in Australia, I got on Grindr and Brad the homo was born, I guess.
Great for Brad, right? But then he was faced with explaining this to his family. The family he loved so much, the family that had always been there for him.
I'm coming out of the closet and I need to tell my family and be open and honest with them, and I've met this guy and I feel like I'll be with him forever. And
like every other time, they supported him.
Everyone was super chill about it. Mum and Dad are amazing. They not only tolerate it, but they celebrate it and they love the person that I am. I know that for a lot of people, it's not really like that. I'm just so fortunate. I really had nothing to be afraid of.
Brad had always wanted to work in commercial radio. He loves, he breathes radio.
It annoys my boyfriend all the time because when we're in a conversation, I've got to make sure to have my strong out to go to ads. He'll be like, oh, what's for dinner tonight? And I'll say, look, you'll find out in about 5 minutes. He's like, I don't need a forward sell. You don't need to hook the next song. Just tell me what's for dinner. So sometimes you really can't shake it out of you. Rihanna. There we go. Boom. I don't know how to talk to you. That's your out.
You just did it to me. Yeah. You just did it.
It works for a reason. There's a method to the madness.
After years of hard work, he landed his dream gig. It was with his radio heroes, Husey and Kate. He was 22 and he'd just fallen in love with his boyfriend.
It was great. Like, everything in life was going absolutely perfectly. I'm too good to you.
I'm way too good to you. You take my love for granted. For his 21st birthday, he got one of those experience vouchers where you do something extreme. He'd always wanted to go skydiving.
I checked the expiry date. Shit, I literally left it to the last day. The lady who was booking me in for my jump said, oh, we have to move the time. Do you mind doing it in the afternoon? I'm like, okay, I'll do it. If the time had been what it was originally planned to be, things could have turned out a lot different. So we rock up to the airport, and typical of my family, they're all there. So mum and dad, my three sisters, my brother-in-laws, my nieces and nephews. Everyone's there at the airport.
Everyone's there.
Yeah. Julie, Brian, Carly, Travis, Nash and Duke, Julian, Nikki, Ayla and Blaze, Jess, Jason.
And Summer. No, Summer wasn't there.
Cancel the weekend plans. We're going to watch Brad do this skydive.
Yeah, totally. They wanted to make a day of it.
Brad got kitted up, went through the tutorial, he signed the forms.
And I meet my tandem instructor, Bill, and he's a really cool guy. And he's very experienced. He's done about 4,000 jumps or something ridiculous like that. And wave goodbye to my family, see you later, jump in the plane. I knew mum was a little bit apprehensive about me doing it, but I think everyone was pretty excited. And the fact that we were spending time together was really nice.
The plane was tiny.
You really can feel all the bumps and grinds as you go through the air and the turbulence. It's like you're flying in a milk crate or something.
The reality kicked in.
Oh, this is a bit of a treacherous situation. We're really high in the air and I'm about to jump towards the ground and leave this plane strapped to some dude I barely know. So I start getting really nervous. I've got sweaty palms and I'm just blabbering on to Bill. And he's trying to reassure me. He's like, come on, get excited, get ready, because this is going to be really amazing. You might be nervous now, but once you're out there, you're just going to experience total euphoria. So when we reach altitude, 15,000 feet in the air, and the door opens, and it's a huge door, it's half the plane. I was sitting in front of Bill, and we're strapped together, and he keeps edging me closer towards the seat of the plane, and so nervous. And he eventually pushes me to the edge, and we're sitting on the edge about to go, and you just see the earth. Everything looks just insignificant. It's just really hard to compute that you're going to fall towards that and somehow survive. Your body is just producing all this fear to protect you. Bill's got a GoPro attached to his wrist and he points it at me and he asks any last words. And I said, yeah, hope my parachute opens. So I'm on the edge of the plane and I'm holding on for dear life and Bill's like, okay, on the count of three, we're gonna go. 3, 2, 1. I was falling, and it's fucking scary, but that 6 or 7 seconds of free fall is euphoric, like Bill said. It was amazing. You're literally falling through the sky with nothing to stop you. I just remember having the biggest smile on my face. It just felt amazing. I feel a huge thrust, and I expected that because I knew that when the parachute would come out, it's catching so much air that you're going to be pulled back. But it didn't feel as strong as I had anticipated. I notice that the parachute is out, but it looks like it's stuck. It's definitely not this huge canopy that I had thought would come out. So that's when we start spinning violently. We're literally spiraling like we're in a washing machine, just shaking everywhere. And I was starting to get really dizzy and I looked up at Bill and I said, what's happening? And he didn't say anything. He was just kind of grunting. It looks like he was trying to maneuver the parachute to open. I was nearly falling out of my harness, which was strapped around my waist really tight. And then I eventually look up again and I see two parachutes. I see a yellow one and a white one, and they're tangled with each other. as we're spinning, a shoe flies off and I start absolutely freaking out. I have no idea what's happening. I'm confused. And the ground is getting closer and closer. I can kind of see Bill. It looks like he's frantically trying to make things work. He's trying to get this parachute to open. The ground is, it's coming. I asked him, are we going to die? And he says, I don't know. We're just hurtling. And I know that the minute I hit the ground is the minute that I die. I had totally accepted it. And I knew that death was coming. And it wasn't this peaceful calm at all. Everything was chaos in my head. The first feeling, the first emotion I can remember feeling was just guilt, guilty for bringing my family there because I thought I had brought them there to watch me die. And I knew that they were all watching, my three sisters, my mum and dad, and my niece and nephew. I knew that they were just watching me fall to the ground and they couldn't see anything. And it was like a slow motion car crash. We eventually hit the ground. It hurt. I don't even really know what else to say or how to describe it. I couldn't even digest the pain. It felt like the earth had come and hit me. That's how painful it was. Like this big seismic shift, the planet had just whacked me. So we're on the ground and half submerged in this lake on a golf course. And I'm on top of Bill, he's underneath me. The canopy, the parachute canopy is on top of us and I'm trying to grab it and I couldn't move anything. I couldn't move my arms, I couldn't move my legs, couldn't move my neck or my back and couldn't breathe, I couldn't hear anything. There's just this weird impact, white noise where I was just trying to compute everything, struggling for air. I'm so winded that I can barely whimper and I'm trying to scream for my life. I was literally trying to make as much noise as I can because I didn't know where the hell we were and I couldn't scream, no noise would come out. And I just started crying. I was crying hysterically, inconsolable, terrified.
After he got some feeling back, he turned to Bill, whose face was blue.
And I'm able to grab onto Bill and trying to get him to wake up, it kind of occurred to me that I'd killed him.
Eventually, Bill woke up.
He just started screaming in pain. I'm trying to get off him, but I can't because we're still strapped together. I can't undo the harness because I can't feel my back or my neck. I can't feel my legs. Obviously, he can't either. So we're literally stuck on each other. And it just felt like the longest time ever.
Some nearby golfers came over to help.
I couldn't move my neck. So I'm just staring at the sky and I've got people talking over me. And they're like, you're going to be okay. You're going to be okay. And what is going on? What has happened? You're going to be okay. You're going to be okay. And then I hear my family come over. I see my boyfriend at the time and I see my sister Jess. Everything's going to be okay. We love you. We're going to see you at the hospital.
I love you. You'll be okay.
We're going to see you at the hospital. And I put them through so much that day. And I know it's not my fault. It's never my fault. And it never will be my fault. The accident is not my fault. But I would never want to make them upset or to traumatize them or to make them for a second think that I was dead. But that's what they thought. Like, they thought I had died. Like, they told me that they were running. They ran through this golf course from the airport. So they ran like over a K to come and see me. And they ran straight to me. When they're at the airport, they're just asking staff, what's happened? What's going on? And the staff at the airport don't know what's happening. So they're like, bugger this. And they just start running. My entire family run after me to come and find me. And I gave them mum and she's not young. So for her to run that far is pretty good. Yeah, I'm so lucky. I had fully accepted death and to be alive and also be stationary on the ground in pain. They're just two very different feelings.
The emotions were overwhelming.
Complete and utter state of confusion. It didn't really stop getting confusing for a long time. I just couldn't understand it. I couldn't digest it. Nothing made sense. Nothing added up. And it actually took months for me to really understand. I was like, what's happening? What's going on? He's like, you'll be okay. That's all everyone kept telling me. Mum and Jess, my sister, my boyfriend and the nurse is like, you'll be okay. It's like, what the fuck happened? What the fuck actually happened?
Brad had broken his upper spine, torn ligaments in his neck. He had cracked ribs, bruising. That first night in the hospital was hellish.
I'm laying in this hospital room and just all these heads hovering over me because I can't move my neck, and they've put me in a neck brace, jabbed with more needles, morphine, more tests and more clipboards and more doctors telling me things to do, and I'm just staring at this white ceiling with these fluorescent lights, and I still just have no idea what's happening. The nurse says, cool, it's bedtime. That's when it really got tough. I'm laying in this dark room in pitch black, and every single time I close my eyes, I'm falling. It's like when you've been at the beach for so long and you can feel the waves when you're not at the beach anymore. It was like that. I could just continuously feel myself falling, and it was terrifying. And it felt so real. Every time I closed my eyes, I was there, and I could feel the wind. I could hear the parachute. I could see Bill, and I'm just hurtling towards the ground again. And again and again, I was just so distraught and traumatized. Unfortunately, that wasn't the end of it. I get home and that's where the next chapter begins. You think things will get easier, but it really didn't. I shut the blinds and I close the door, and then I feel like that was the next 4 months of my life. I was just laying in bed, feeling sorry for myself, being depressed, being anxious, being triggered and traumatized constantly, and just being a total burden for my family. I didn't want to talk to my mum. I was yelling at mum constantly. Every time she'd come into my room, I'd tell her to fuck off, and I didn't want to see my sister. I didn't want to see the kids. Just wouldn't take help from anyone. Just completely secluded myself. It was just cyclical. Days and days of yelling at my parents, not seeing my friends, not showering, not shaving, everything's dark. I'm just
depression, bullying.
Sitting on YouTube all day, all night. I'd sometimes wake up and go to the kitchen and it's like 3 a.m. on a Wednesday, and I thought it was Saturday morning or something. Just had no sense of reality.
Be sure to subscribe, get ready, it starts next week. Bye, friends.
Even in his sleep, Brad was battling the skydiving memory.
I'd be ripping pillows open, and I'd be throwing lamps on the ground, and I'd be slamming doors, and I wouldn't know what I was doing because I'd just woken up from a night terror that feels so real and so authentic that it's almost still happening. And mum would have to come in and physically restrain me and tell me that everything's okay. For 4 months, this happened. I knew I had post-traumatic stress disorder. I knew I had depression. I knew I had insomnia. I knew I had night terrors, and I was just a total beast.
But the truth is that you're not really a monster. You're just trying to deal with what you'd been through.
Totally. I thought I'd brought this on myself. So because I had so much guilt, I thought people are supporting me. I'm not worthy. I don't deserve that. I'm a bad person. Look what I put myself through. And now look what I'm doing to my family and the amount of strain I'm putting on them.
Guilt. That is the ongoing emotion Brad felt. Like many people who face trauma, he's tried to rationalize how, why this freak accident happened. But the problem is, it's just that. It's a freak accident.
There's a lot of details in that 4 month period that my family don't know about. And I was always shy about telling them about my feelings because I didn't want to upset them. The real crescendo in that 4 month recovery probably came about 2 months in. It's taken me 4 years to actually say out loud that there was a point in my life where I wanted to kill myself. And it's scary because I never would have been able to discover the life that I have now. It's a one in a trillion chance that never happens. How can someone survive with minimal injuries after falling 15,000 feet? That's got to mean something. And even though I'm confused now and I don't know what that reason is, I might know that reason one day.
To get through this hard time, Brad says he had to understand the grief he was feeling about losing the person he was before the accident. Now, that sounds a bit confusing, but it makes sense because no matter what he tried or did, Brad was never going to be the same person again.
I was mourning the loss of old Brad because old Brad had so much potential. He wanted to be a superstar radio announcer and he had a lot of friends and he was a popular guy and he just entered this new relationship and had this amazing job. And in the back of my mind, hoped and prayed that I could get back to where I was. That Brad had to die, metaphorically, for me to be where I am now. I really had to mourn the old Brad. He's not coming back. This is the new you.
It's been a slow process and it's still ongoing.
I thought it'd be a quick fix. I thought, cool, I'll have the braces off and I'll be off the drugs and I'll be back at work and boom, Bob's your uncle. I'll be fine. And I wasn't quite like that.
It's coming up to 4 years since the accident. And just in the past few months, Brad's life has really started to hit its straps again.
I literally have the perfect life right now. Everything's aligned. An amazing job, a brilliant partner who supports me in everything that I do. Such a loving support network in my family. And it just goes to show that you could be at the deepest, darkest depths of despair where you want to end it all, but you can turn it around. It was a miracle that I survived that day, but the other miracle is that I'm here, I'm living, I'm breathing, and I am killing it. I feel amazing.
Brad's had every type of reaction to his story.
Sometimes I'm a bit blunt when I tell them. It's like if someone got raped and you said to them, oh my God, tell me more about the rapist. Oh my God, you survived. That's so good. Like, was it scary? Did you get like full depressed after? You wouldn't do that. I'm not bitter at them. I understand why they'd be so curious because I'd be curious too. It's a miraculous story. You never ever hear about it. But I've had some people that even when I so explicitly and politely tell them it's not really something I talk about, they'll still push and then they'll get angry that I'm not giving them the information that they want. I get humiliated when I have to tell people I can't really get scared. I can't work in tall buildings. Elevators frighten me. I can't hear wind. There's so many triggers that I have and people just think it's weird rather than trying to support and adapt to your mental health.
Brad's not a hero for falling. He is a hero for grappling, rebuilding, surviving the effects of what came after that incident. And post-traumatic stress is still a part of his life. And now he wants to get serious about promoting awareness for others who suffer. And that starts with his family.
We're all going through stuff. Me being gay and my other sisters having their own issues, but we just never spoke about it because mental health just wasn't something you would chat about. Having mental health issues with someone in the family, in a close-knit family, you all suffer, you all experience it, even if it's just a little residual effect. But that's what it's like when you've got a support network, you kind of all carry the weight.
Okay, so here we are, we're just walking. We're gonna check out the studio. Here we go.
Yes. So this is my stool and it's just my space to be me.
Nowadays, his support network extends to his online family as well.
I just like showing a bit of nip every now and then if I need to. This, dude, this is what we go and festy with.
Each week he makes a video for his YouTube channel.
Yo, so Mother's Day is this Saturday in Australia and I really wanted to do something special for my mum.
I guess Brad the YouTuber all started because of the accident.
I'm so excited.
When I was watching so much YouTube to pass the time, I discovered vloggers and people that would blog about their life.
It's all about celebrating queer life, amplifying disenfranchised voices.
And it really inspired me. It really showed me that things do get better.
I'll also apologize for that time I shaved off a bit of my eyebrow because
for me, it's a really cathartic process of being able to talk about my thoughts and feelings and also just be able to express myself.
Not only am I passionate about the environment, but I love getting outdoors and shit.
I'm here, I'm thriving, and I've got a mission to do. I don't have time to sit here and be sad. Life is there to be lived, and you need to grip it and rip it.
If this episode has brought up issues for you, contact Lifeline on 13 11 14. You can see pictures of Brad and Mike and I being stupid by checking out at The Real Thing Podcast on Instagram. And if you're new to The Real Thing, welcome.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you for being here. Please hit subscribe and be part of our real family we've got going here. And if you have time and you're on iTunes, maybe leave us a little review. We'd really appreciate it.
What we'll probably do is I have this at the end of the episode. It'll be something like, I want to tell you about this lady I used to work with.
Work for.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Sorry, that's right. You were my boss.
That was like the pinnacle of your career.
Hey, Timothy, I want to tell you about this woman I used to work with. Mm-hmm. Used to work for on RN Drive.
You're doing really well under the circumstances.
Her name's Beverly Wang.
Oh, I know Bev. Sure.
Now, there's three things that come to mind when I think about working with Bev.
I remember you were very strict about the writing on the website. Do you remember that?
Strict, like I wanted things not to be mistakes.
Yeah, I guess. Second thing was,
is your partner still a kickboxer?
He's a high school teacher.
Didn't he do kickboxing?
He does martial arts.
But the thing I remember most was,
whenever race or racism, discrimination came up, you always were up for having a discussion, exploring it. You used to get fired up.
Did I? Okay.
Well, she did. And now she's got a new RN podcast where she's diving into identity, culture, difference.
It's called It's Not a Race, and it's good.
It was kind of a joke that I made up the tagline, It's the Podcast Australia Needs Right Now. But it's really getting reflected back to me that, yeah, it does seem to be filling a gap that people really, really want filled.
As a Taiwanese Canadian living in Australia, Bev's been thinking about these kind of issues since she was young.
I remember going around telling people that I wanted to be called Cindy, like Cindy Brady. Blonde, curly haired. How did I pick that up? How did I pick up that it was going to be really good to be a little blonde, curly haired, blue eyed girl? It's also a little bit sad. It's also quite normal, I think. I think a lot of kids go through that.
Thanks for that, Cindy. Beverly. Sorry. The first episode of It's Not a Race, you come out of the blocks with blackface. Episode 2 asks some big questions about landmark Australian film Jeddah. And we did notice that comedian Jennifer Wong mentioned the bamboo ceiling that you've punched a hole in.
Yes.
Now, to help you punch through more ceilings, kick in more doors, break down more walls, the real thing, we got you a little present. Did you bring it, Timothy?
Hold on. It's just under the table.
One sec.
Oh, my goodness.
I'm getting it out.
One sec, here we go.
Yeah.
Here we go. Ready?
Oh, man.
Petrol in it? Is it? One sec.
There we go.
Beverly White.
Oh, my God.
You like it?
I love it. Nobody has ever given me an audio chainsaw before.
It's Not a Race is a new ABC podcast. Subscribe now.
I'm Mike Williams.
I'm Timothy Nicastri.
That's episode 15 of The Real Thing.
That's episode 15 of The Real Thing.